This is The Source on KSTX, a product of the Texas Public Radio Newsroom. I'm David Martin Davies. Could staying in a hospital bed actually be the third leading cause of death in the country? That's what a recent study has estimated in the Journal of Patient Safety, pegging the number of deaths between 200 and 400,000. There's some dispute about those deaths that's annually here in America, but that number is pretty squishy. We're going to get into that. So what happens when the error has been made, when people's lives are altered? What is the hospital required to tell you about what went wrong? What should they do? What role does apology and forgiveness play in communicating with patients? Lee Taft joins us. He is a litigator who has written extensively and trained hospitals in seeking genuine forgiveness after medical error. Also in the studio, we have Dr. Ruth Bergen. She is the director of the Center for Medical Humanities and Ethics at the UT Health Science Center and an advocate for telling patients more. Welcome to The Source.
Thank you for having us.
Mr. Taft, when you hear these numbers, okay, right now, this is get to the heart of this thing about the numbers. We're hearing 100,000, 200,000, 400,000. Why is it so undetermined how big of a problem this is?
Well, it's not in a hospital's best interest to be reporting patient injuries. And there's a profit side. And so there's underreporting. So when the IOM study came out in 1999, reporting somewhere between 44,000 and 98,000 deaths per year, the immediate response was there were two responses. There was an outcry first saying that those numbers were exaggerated. There was another response saying they were probably grossly underestimated. What I know that Ruth and I have talked about is that regardless of the numbers, that it's clear that what the evidence shows is that medical error is in the top 10 of causes of death of people in the United States.
When we say medical error, is it an avoidable medical error, something that should not have happened, or is it just accidents happen and you know, just got to factor that into the ebb and flow of the universe?
Yeah, medical errors.
Ruth, go ahead.
Medical errors are defined as adverse events that are preventable with the current state of knowledge. So an error is a preventable adverse medical event.
So it could have been avoided.
Right.
And so, Mr. Taft, I mean, what do you think? Should have been avoided, should not have happened.
I mean, I think that one of the things that we have to sort of in capturing the conversation is to remember what sort of a high-risk world we're dealing with in the healthcare environment. And I think that we have to be careful when we focus on patient injuries. We also have to have some reflection on the millions and millions of positive outcomes. And so part of in my own work that I'm interested in, yes, we need to talk about error. Yes, we have to have response to error. And we also want to have the public's awareness to have a different perception. It isn't fair to expect healthcare delivery to be perfect. We can't expect doctors and nurses who care for us to be perfect. They're human beings. And so when we're thinking about error, we're thinking of something here. You know, a broad definition is any injury caused by medical care. And a more narrow definition is the definition that Ruth has just offered us.
All right. So, Dr. Bergen, let me ask you, let's bring forgiveness into the conversation now. What role, it's asking a lot of people, don't you think, to go to forgiveness when an avoidable accident, some mistake was made, and now someone in your family is no longer there?
Yeah, so that's kind of a little bit down the line of the sequence of events that need to actually happen. So the most important thing is that a preventable adverse event be recognized right away and that it be disclosed appropriately to the patient if they're alive and able to process the information or their loved ones who are there. And there shouldn't be any delay in that. And it's very important that this be done in a caring and compassionate manner that demonstrates respect for persons. And importantly, if a patient doesn't know that an adverse event has occurred, they're not really equipped to make subsequent decisions about their medical care in an informed way. So it's part of informed consent. the person can't go on and continue to make decisions about their care unless they know what's already happened.
Okay, so what should
I tag on to that just a second on the forgiveness? So imagine this. Imagine you're looking at your watch, and imagine that at 12 o'clock is where the moment when a patient is harmed. And at 3 o'clock, there is an opportunity in the immediate wake of harm for the doctor, nurse, or institution to make a choice in how they will respond to that harm. In a sequence of moving from harm to forgiveness, so 3 o'clock, that's the opportunity for accountability. 6 o'clock is forgiveness. So there's a relationship between a patient's forgiveness at 6 o'clock and how the doctor, nurse, hospital respond to the patient. And so the question is what Ruth is saying. You want an authentic response. So there is a movement within the response to disclose what the error is, to apologize if it is a result of something that was preventable. And then there is some accommodation offered, a thoughtful apology, but critically lessons learned. That's a full movement of accountability that can invite forgiveness, both from the patient and for the doctor or nurse who has made a mistake, from themselves and their institution.
So, Dr. Bergeron, you're talking to hospitals and doctors, and you're telling them an appropriate way to handle these very difficult situations. What are you telling them?
Well, I represent the Center for Medical Humanities and Ethics at the UT Health Science Center, and part of our mission is teaching ethics and professionalism. And in all of the professional codes for surgeons, for internists, the AMA, the American Nursing Association, all of us have codes of professional conduct that include in them the duty to disclose error. And underlying those duties are a number of ethical principles and concepts that lead to these duties.
Right, but I get that. And how do these doctors, they need help. I mean, this is very tough. I mean, you've got to go out there and tell a family some pretty tough news, and you want to do it in a way that's transparent and thoughtful and authentic. That's not easy to do. It takes a special person to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest barrier is, of course, the anxiety and fear that a professional has about their reputation. Disclosing an error could result in everybody thinking ill of that physician. All of their peers might think badly of
them.
They're
also thinking about getting sued. That's right. A possibility.
That's right. And so there is a very human reaction to want to not have to talk about something if it isn't absolutely necessary to talk about. And
right.
And this has led to a culture of silence.
Right. And so when you say, we're opening up our phone lines. Our number is 614-8980, 614-8980. We're talking about what happens of medical errors that lead to death, and sometimes and the process of forgiveness and transparency from doctors and hospitals. And this is The Source on KSTX, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. Have you been impacted by a medical error? What would an apology have meant to you at that time? We want to hear from you. Give us a call. The number is 614-8980, 614-8980. With me to talk about that in the studio, we have Dr. Ruth Bergeron. She is director of the Center for Medical Humanities and Ethics at the UT Health Science Center. And on the line, we've got Lee Taft. He's a litigator. He's written extensively. He's training hospitals to seeking genuine forgiveness after medical errors. So you can't ask people to forgive you. How do you get people how do you open the door for forgiveness? And maybe they walk through or maybe they don't. Mr. Taft.
I think that's the invitation is begins with the hospital and the doctor's open and transparent communication with the patient to show them they're not going to go through the traditional what's called defend and deny to not tell the patient what's going on, but to invite the invitation. With what Dr. Bergeron was saying just before our break, this idea that there's it's a challenge for doctors because of the fear of litigation, because of the fear of judgment from their peers, because they themselves are what's called in the literature, they doctors and nurses who are a part of medical mistake are called the second victims of the mistake. They also are suffering differently, but there is a suffering that happens to someone who sets out to heal and causes harm instead. So this conversation requires training and education and encouragement, which is why Ruth and I will be doing this work we'll be doing in San Antonio next week, is working with doctors and nurses and hospitals about how do you develop authentic processes of transparency and how do you have the skills and tools to step into the complicated conversation that's invited by in the wake of mistake.
So Dr. Bergen, it seems like a lot of people, when they're in a situation, this happened to them and their family, their reaction is not necessarily one of anger, but they're concerned. They don't want to see this happen to somebody else.
That's right. I mean, they want people to deal with them honestly, and then they'd like to know what's the game plan. Okay, something bad happened. It's really unfortunate. Now what? And what are you going to do for me, the injured person, or the family of the injured person? But also, what are you going to do for all of those other patients that this might happen to? And how are you going to assure that this doesn't happen to anybody else?
So they want to see an investigation and corrective measures taken.
Yeah.
And are hospitals willing to do that?
Absolutely. And most hospitals have explicit written policies about error disclosure that have in them a lot of directives about how promptly the error needs to be recognized and reported, who is going to make up the team that goes in to disclose the error, what kind of apology can be made, and then ultimately what sort of restitution can be made to the patient and their family, and finally what can be done to prevent this error from happening in the future.
And so, Mr. Taft, do you think that a lot of people, they want answers. They want real answers about what happened. I mean, my wife, my sister, my mother, they all go into the surgery, and we're told one thing's going to happen and something dramatically different happened. And what went wrong? And we weren't in that surgery room. How do we get those answers?
That's precisely the point of disclosure. There's a huge gap, though, in what Dr. Bergeron just described, that it's true hospitals mostly have these policies in place. Since 2001, the Joint Commission, the organization that accredits hospitals, has required hospitals to have in place policies and procedures for disclosing what are called these unanticipated outcomes. But what the data shows is less than 30% of these events are actually communicated to the patient. So there is this huge gap between having a policy and procedure in place as a practical matter and then the actual, though, communication occurring. So most patients are still not being given the transparent information that they so desperately need in the wake of an untoward event in their health care. That's why we're doing the work we're going to be doing next week, is helping doctors and nurses and institutions learn how to do this better so that they can close the gap between having a policy and having the policy come alive on the floor.
So after the surgery, something bad happens and the doctor comes out and talks to the family. And, you know, I remember when this happened to me, and all we got was this a lot of medical mumble jumble. And I wasn't even sure what he was saying. And after he left, we were like, what just happened? Was what our reaction was. Does anyone know what he was saying to us? And then somebody said, yeah, you know, mom's not going to make it. And, you know, why can't we just get a straight answer?
You know, that is, of course, what we're striving for. And it starts early in medical training. It starts in medical school. So we inculcate these values and teach the professional ethical conduct codes to our trainees early on, and we hope that as we get better at it, as doctors get better at communicating with their patients, that we'll start to make significant improvements, not only in the communication area, but in the work that we do to address medical errors on a systems level, to find out what systematically went wrong within a hospital that led to, say, somebody's wrong leg being amputated, to put measures in place to prevent those things from happening.
Okay, we're going to go to the phones. The number is 614-8980. Joe is on the line. Joe, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. My brother woke up sick, took him to the hospital, his wife did. They thought he had a heart attack because of his symptoms. They gave him blood thinners. And then it turns out they did a scan of his brain, and he had an aneurysm that had burst. And because of the blood thinners, they could not do brain surgery. And so we had to stand there and watch him die. That was tough. No one thought about culpability. We were so sad, so sudden, so upset. Later on, weeks later, I'm thinking, why wouldn't they look at the symptoms and do a brain scan before they gave him the blood thinners? That's all I have to say.
Joe, I'm so sorry for your loss there, buddy. Thanks for calling in. So, Dr. Bergen, what can you say to Joe?
Well, first of all, that is a tragic story, and it's very sad to hear about those, and many of us have had loved ones who've experienced tragic events. And in the world of what goes wrong out there, we talk about adverse events, which is when bad stuff happens, and we talk about medical errors, which is when somebody who ought to have known better or has knowledge that could have prevented an error makes an error. And you have the overlap, which is when somebody makes an error and it actually results in the adverse event. And a much smaller proportion of those are the negligent ones where actually there was negligence to meet the standard of care and harm resulted. And so it's hard to know when you hear a sad and very unfortunate story what level we're dealing with. And sometimes adverse events occur in spite of people meeting the standard of care.
So I'm not a doctor, and I don't know what happens. I mean, is it standard operating procedures that you would do some sort of scan, that what they did was not the best way to treat somebody? And how do you get those kind of answers? And that's what, you know, family members kind of want. Was this an oversight that resulted in my family member, you know, not making it? Or was this just the way things sometimes, you know, it was in the cards, Mr. Taft?
Your question is a great question. I mean, I helped Stanford Hospitals design the procedure that they follow in the wake of medical mistake. So we hear this sad and tragic case that your caller just told us about. And so what's to happen, this is why this conversation, this disclosure, is necessarily an interdisciplinary conversation. So it asks the question, in the wake of this unanticipated outcome, this terrible turn in hospital and medical care. So the starting place is you have to ask the question, was there a protocol in place and should there have been? This is a question that as a lawyer, as a layperson, we don't know the answer to it. So we can ask the question, and then we need the medical response to say, yes, there should have been a protocol in place, or no, there wasn't. But what happened is because of this tragedy, we've learned that in the future, before we do, we will scan in advance of administering a kind of medication. So we will do a prophylactic scan, we'll see where we are, and then we'll make a medication decision. So sometimes what happens is we have a tragic outcome that actually invites medical progress, because from the event, something is learned that was not known before the event. So that's why in a disclosure program, there's a process. You asked earlier this question of why does the doctor sometimes not give us all the information? Sometimes it surprises us as lay people to realize that doctors don't know everything. And so sometimes what happens in the wake of an unfortunate, tragic event is that in that immediate moment, the facts are unclear. Why what happened isn't necessarily understood. That's why these disclosure conversations require a partnership between doctors and patients so that the doctor can say, I don't know now, but this is what I'm going to do to learn why this happened, and this is why I will report back. They're sequential and ongoing conversations that require collaboration and conversation.
So, Mr. Taft, this actually does reduce, when you do all these things, it reduces the number of lawsuits that are filed against hospitals and doctors. How does that work?
Well, it's interesting is that you would think that when a hospital is going to disclose that a patient may not know that something untoward has happened, and so a hospital and a doctor make a decision to disclose, you would think, wow, there'll be a huge spike in litigation. And that is what some academic studies, theoretical studies would suggest. But what is really happening when you look at empirical and anecdotal experiences is that the number of lawsuits is actually dropping. Because patients aren't having many patients, the data was showing, were suing in order to find out what happened. And because disclosure provides that incredibly important explanation, that lawsuits sometimes aren't happening when they're exploratory. And so, for instance, you have the University of Michigan that in 1997 they initiated a very proactive disclosure program in their university hospital system. By 2007, the number of lawsuits that the University of Michigan was experiencing had been cut in half. Stanford, the system that I helped design, they have a 5-year study, and their claims are down by 36% 5 years into the program.
So, Dr. Bergman, as you work with doctors, young doctors, they're getting, do they have a lot of anxiety? They worry about one of these days, I'm going to mess up.
Well, everybody does. And if they tell you they don't, they're not being completely truthful about
them?
It. So, you know, it's easier to talk to the younger ones that are earlier in their training than people that are established. And the important thing is to show them what has been able to be accomplished at programs like at the University of Michigan and the Stanford Pearl program that Mr. Taft described, and to help them realize that it's not only about them, their career, it's also about doing the right thing by the patient and, very importantly, addressing this issue of patient safety. We have to talk about error openly if we're going to find out how to prevent errors and make hospitals safer places for patients.
And that's the goal, you know, being able to go to the hospital and come out with the intended outcome. And I want to thank Dr. Ruth Bergren. She's the director of the Center for Medical Humanities and Ethics at the UT Health Science Center. Lee Taft on the line. He's a litigator who's written extensively and trained hospitals in seeking genuine forgiveness after medical error. He's coming to San Antonio in a week or two.
October 1st. He'll be presenting at University of the Incarnate Word in the Sky Room from 9 to 10 a.m. We'll have a keynote, and there'll be a workshop following.
All right. Well, thank you so much. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're talking about Ted Cruz. This is The Source on KSTX.